The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back, America. Whenever I play Red River Ball, it means we're about to deal with President Biden and Vice President Harris, and I try and be upbeat when we do that. Molly Hemingway from Fox News and The Federalist, of course, joins us. I do not know, Molly, if you've ever even heard Red River Ball, given it was written a decade before you were born.
Of course I have.
Okay. Well, that's what I play when I'm about to go through it. I've asked you to come in this morning and translate the president and the vice president from yesterday. Here's cut number one, Joe Biden being asked about Kevin McCarthy coming to the White House. Cut number one.
Tell me your budget, I'll show you mine.
Mr. President, what is your message? What is your message to Leader McCarthy? To Speaker McCarthy. Sorry, sir. What would be your message?
Show me your budget, I'll show you mine.
Show me your budget, I'll show you mine, Molly Hemingway. What's that mean?
Well, I actually think that we're in a little bit better place than we were last week when Joe Biden was refusing to accept the results of the 2022 midterm elections and acknowledge that Republicans had won the House and that you can't treat such a thing as something that didn't happen or as if the people who won the House are not people that you can negotiate with. And so I think he's backtracking on what he said last week when he wouldn't talk to them at all to say, obviously, we need to negotiate the debt limit.
Oh, we love that. We think that that's Red River Ball talk. Cut number two, Joe Biden.
I ran for president to build an economy from the bottom up and the middle out, to bring back good paying jobs you can raise a family on, whether or not you went to college, to give working families a little more breathing room.
Molly Hemingway, U.S. consumer is starting to freak out is the headline in the Wall Street Journal this morning. Do you think the U.S. family has more breathing room?
It's actually offensive to hear him speak this way with what he's done in terms of spending to lead to such high inflation, which hurts the poor and middle class far more than it hurts the rich. But no, things are not better for these people.
Okay, we have back-to-back Amtrak quotes coming up, Molly. It's never very nice in the morning to hear this, but let's do it anyway. Cut number three, Amtrak number one.
Anytime I see a train door open, I head for it. By the way, I can say it now since I know there's different leadership. I used to about 15% of the time ride with the engineers, for real. And I'm the only guy that I'm aware of when I stopped riding Amtrak that had a key to get in the back.
So, Molly, this is like Grandpa Thanksgiving. I don't know if you ever had to sit next to Grandpa Thanksgiving. I had to always sit next to Grandpa Thanksgiving because I was the youngest of the grandchildren. This is a Grandpa Thanksgiving story, isn't it?
Well, if your grandpa is someone who lies, then yes, Grandpa Thanksgiving story, but I think these things have been debunked time and time again. It's kind of sad to hear him talk this way. And the only thing I think is interesting about his Amtrak rides is how many documents he was taking with him on them.
No, you're right. Amtrak was a skiff and we didn't even know it. Cut number four, the last Biden cut. Cut number four.
When I was vice president, I flew over 1,000,000 miles on Air Force Two. And I was going home as a United States, as vice president. One of the conductors said to me, "Hey, Joe, big deal, 200. You said you've traveled over 1,000,000 miles on Amtrak. So how the hell do you know that?" And they added it up at there. But folks, look.
Do you believe that, Molly? We've heard that before, too. It's like his greatest hits.
I've heard it before. I don't believe it. And I'm more concerned that he might believe it to be true than anything else.
The president is infirm. That's my word. What do you make of my word choice? He's infirm.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I mean, we'll all, if we're blessed to live as long as he has and to have the kind of life he has, we may experience some of these same things ourselves. I don't judge him for it. but it's extremely uncomfortable to listen and watch.
Oh, yeah, especially when General Minahan says we're going to war in China in next year. Let's turn to the vice president, who, of course, being young and dynamic, will provide us nothing but precise and inspiring bits. Cut number five at a White House teleconference with small business owners.
When we talk about our small businesses, it not only is it intergenerational, but also we've got entrepreneurs in their teens and 20s to families who have been doing this for generations and, in, you know, our seniors. And so it's really, that's also what's also exciting about our small businesses and who they are, because it spans the generations in addition to being intergenerational.
So, Molly Hemingway, the reason we bring you on, you are a big-time television star. So intergenerational and multi-generational and spanning the generations. I'm just a Harvard guy. I thought they all meant the same thing. What do you think?
I think she was, I have no idea. I really don't. I love her. I love listening to her poetry. I think she's the best insurance policy that has ever been purchased in history. Joe, you know, she's very much keeping Joe Biden in power because nobody wants that at the top of the helm, but I have no idea what she
You think they're going to bump her, throw her from the train, throw mama from the train? Is that going to happen?
I think if they decide that they want to get rid of, I sort of think it's up to the Democratic establishment. They have really good control over their party. They can decide who's going to be there, who's going to win their primary or what's going to happen to them. But I mean, we'll see.
I'm looking for Josh Shapiro to be the vice president in 2024. Cut number six, more Kamala Harris.
Let's talk about how you get a line of credit. Who of us grew up with our parents talking about a phrase line of credit, right? These are things you learn if someone takes the time to teach you.
Molly, did your parents ever tell you what a line of credit was?
I'm just shocked that this is who the vice president is and that this is a daily occurrence and that it's not getting any better and that she – it's just – it's embarrassing. And I'm just sitting here shaking my head with my mouth open because I cannot believe that this keeps going on.
I've got three more. Here's cut number seven.
We are doing the work that is about collaborating around the small businesses that will need to do the work that will be the result of all the trillions of dollars we're putting into the infrastructure of our country, including the almost $1 trillion that we're going to be putting into a whole new economy that is called a clean energy economy.
What'd you make of that? Spending $1 trillion?
I appreciate that the audience was trying to encourage her along there where they are applauding. And I mean, was that yesterday?
Yes.
You saying?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think she's, you know, she's doing traditional vice president work there. You're trying to come out and talk about your great accomplishments, which she's struggling to articulate.
Well, she talks about the need for collaborating around small businesses and what they do. And then you tell me we can't play the yellow school bus. That's the best clip.
No.
Oh, my gosh. We had a yellow school bus clip yesterday.
So the yellow school bus is great, though, because this is another one of her greatest hits that she gets stuck on. She thinks it's cute that she has this obsession with buses. It's like a safe place for her to talk about. And it really is impressive that this woman rose to the vice presidency with such bad retail politicking skills, and yet she did.
Yeah, I was totally tricked because I was living in the California blue bubble, which is the all-encompassing blue bubble of all blue bubbles, and I thought she had skill sets. And I told everyone, I thought she was going to be the nominee. I thought she had skill sets because she just crushed good nominees out here when she ran for attorney general. And the fact is, if you run in California, you can have a glass jaw that shatters if a tweezer hits it, and you don't know because in California it's all Democratic. She's truly a terrible politician, Molly Hemingway.
She is, but she has great media support. And I remember during the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings when she, you know, was really getting a lot of favorable press coverage. If you actually looked at what she was doing in going after him, it didn't really withstand any pressure, but the media coverage was just fantastic for it. So it's only when people are given an opportunity to see her in a straightforward way that they can really understand what's going on there.
So, Molly, we come back to this and our machine is frozen. When the Republican nominee seeks to find a running mate, they've got to pick one with Kamala Harris in mind. who matches up best against her on a stage.
Well, and it's one of those reasons why I'm actually not sure they can drop her for Shapiro, because it would be very difficult to get rid of the only female on their ticket. But that's probably one of the reasons why Republicans are thinking a lot about a Kristi Noem or a Nikki Haley. Although I don't know, I actually don't love it when people pick for that type of reason. And, you know, and I thought Mike Pence actually did a great job debating her in the 2020 or in the, yeah, in 2020. So, who knows?
I sort of believe Tim Scott will be our vice president, regardless of who the nominee is. But here is the yellow school bus, cut number 9.
Are these new green buses going to keep their signature yellow color?
These are going to remain yellow school buses, because who doesn't love a yellow school bus? They will remain yellow, but their heart will be green.
Yeah, Molly, when people laugh at their own jokes, it is a giveaway to me that they are deeply insecure about their ability to be funny. Is that your reaction?
I don't know, but it is just embarrassing to listen to her. And both she and the vice president sometimes have this air of being like a 4-year-old that you have to be really gentle with, that is not, you know, not reaching their full intellectual capacity at this age. But
you know, my 3-year-old granddaughter, Genghis Kate, I call her, does not need to be coddled. She'll cut you to pieces if you turn your back on her, and she'll be gone with all the candy and cookies. She's got more of a plan than Kamala Harris does. I really am confused. And we have a minute left, Molly. The media pays no attention to Kamala Harris. None at all. By media, I mean legacy media. You'll see her show up occasionally. Are they just afraid it's bad news, or are they trying to protect her?
There's no way that it's based on reality, because like if it were Republican vice president, this would be the nonstop topic of late night shows, Saturday Night Live, and of course, much of cable punditry. But for some reason, she's completely protected. And I think it's just like what it's been for years. They know that if they analyze these people in detail, it will not work well for Democrats.
Yeah, Dan Quayle, I'm going to sit down here in Phoenix, and I helped the vice president, former vice president, write a book once. He's a wonderful, smart, brilliant guy. And he must just shake his head saying, I misspelled potato once because it was on a card that way. And I was forever classified as the not bright guy. And Kamala Harris every day makes potato look like he won the spelling bee. Molly Hemingway, MZ Hemingway on Twitter. Thank you, Molly, for being up early. Only Molly can translate the president and the vice president like nobody else. Stay tuned, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt. David M. Drucker on Twitter is now with the Dispatch, where he writes their weekly dispatch on American politics. David, good morning to you. How are you?
Great, Hugh. Good morning.
Ronna McDaniel won easily. I was at the convention, the Republican National Committee winter meeting. She won by 70% of the ballots on the first ballot. This was a non-story that became a story because Harmeet was very verbal and very loud, and she has a lot of good friends, and I salute her running, and Mike Lindell was there, and Mike always creates media attention. But why does the media create storylines when there is no storyline, David?
Well, because we have to cover something even if we don't have to cover it, and it's much more interesting to cover if there's a storyline. We're likely to have more readers if there's a storyline. Now, I will say, Hugh, and that's just, by the way, that's the journalism answer. I know I'm sounding a little glib there.
Yeah.
So we always look for a way to make it look more interesting. I will say that Harmeet had a lot of grassroots outside activist support. There are different, as you know, factions within the Republican Party. And outside of the voting members, she had a lot of vocal support. Of course, the way you win that race is to run an inside game catering to the 168. You don't bring outside pressure to bear. Even though she is one of the voting 168 RNC members, she really relied on outside pressure. That's just not the way you win a race like that.
This is a key point. I actually got credentialed, applied for, got credentialed, and attended the Southern meeting of the party chairman from all the states in the South. They had a wonderful year, by the way. West Virginia won everything. North Carolina won everything. Florida won everything. Tennessee won everything. Stuff you don't hear about, down ticket, et cetera. And you listen, you take notes, and it's 5 to 7 minute reports from 12 different state members. It can be a little bit tedious and boring, but I found it interesting. I didn't see one other journalist in the room, David. The horse race was covered everywhere. I think our business falls into the horse race trap all the time.
Well, I agree with you to a degree in that I think we focus far more on polling and who's up and who's down and who's beating up on who than we should, in that we're missing other really good stories, and then we fail to provide the kind of context that can give readers and just interested political observers, people even a part of the process, a fuller picture of what is happening with any given story.
Now, I want to ask you a premonitory question. You don't have any idea. I want your premonition. Mitch Daniels is 73 years old. He's a wonderful man, a great conservative, president of Purdue, governor of Indiana, OMB director, everyone. Jim Banks is 45 and a veteran. Jim Banks should be the next senator from Indiana, but Mitch is bored, I guess, and is thinking about running for Senate. Do the senators sitting around the table tell him, thanks, Mitch, but no thanks? Why don't you take a job in the next Republican administration? We need some young blood. Is that what they do?
I don't know, because senators that are Mitch Daniels' age don't want to go anywhere, and they don't think of themselves as too old. I think in the Senate, you don't really think you're too old until you're 90-something. So, look, I think there are a faction of Republican senators that are going to hope that Jim Banks or somebody like him is the nominee, because once you're the nominee in Indiana, you're going to win the general election, most likely. And then I think there is another faction of the Senate Republican Conference that would like to see somebody like Governor Daniels, who's a little bit more focused on fiscal issues, less focused on cultural issues, because they feel like they may be able to get more done in that regard. So I just think it depends on where they are coming from.
But David, confirm or deny if you want. You've got to be there 10 years before anyone even knows your name in the Senate. You don't get to be until, but you're the last guy on the dais asking a question at 73.
Well, look, I'm not going to argue with you that being he'd be a 75-year-old freshman by the time he takes office or something like that. That's a little bit up there, but I will say, and your point is well taken, by the way, but I will say in recent years, we have seen freshmen come in their late 60s and early 70s, and the U.S. Senate seems to be a place for, you know, some aspiring politicians to go, where they feel they can be more effective in the issues that they care about. So it's just not as unusual these days as it was maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago.
And I want to draw a line. I got nothing against older senators serving. I think Mitch McConnell saved the Constitution. I think he's a wily, tough old bird, and I hope he serves for another 10 years. But he got there in 84. That's why he's good at it.
Right.
It's such a bizarre place that you've got to get there in 84 to learn how to run it in 2024.
Well, that's correct. And look, I think also, I look at it from this vantage point. A lot of times, Republicans and Democrats, for that matter, will recruit a governor, a wealthy businessman who's had a very full career. They come into the Senate late in life. Late in life, you tend to be a little bit more impatient for obvious reasons. You've been an executive. You have all the answers. You get to the Senate and you realize what a process it is. It tends to move slow. But even when it doesn't, it's got its own irrational rationality that you have to learn. And it can be a very frustrating place to try and be effective with your time at that stage in life.
Very well said, David M. Drucker, over at the Dispatch. How often are you writing for the Dispatch, David?
A couple times a week. Where I can find a scoop, where I can find impactful reporting, then I'm writing.
Head over to the Dispatch if you love David Drucker, and we do, for our Tuesday edition of David M. Drucker. Follow him on Twitter as well, of course, David M. Drucker. Thank you, David. Don't go anywhere, America. Hour number two of the Hugh Hewitt Show is straight ahead.
Look, you did the tough thing during COVID. You paid your people and pulled your business through the pandemic, or really the lockdown. And now, doing the tough thing could qualify you for up to $26,000 per employee at COVIDtaxrelief.org. Government funds are available to reward companies with two or more employees who stayed open during COVID. This is not a loan, and you don't have to pay it back. The program is complicated, but nobody knows more about it than the CPAs and tax experts at COVIDtaxrelief.org. You pay nothing up front. They do all the work and share a percentage of the cash they get you. Businesses of all types, including nonprofits and churches, can qualify, including those who took PPP loans, even if you had increases in sales. You did the tough thing for your employees during COVID. Let COVIDtaxrelief.org help you get up to $26,000 per employee. Visit COVIDtaxrelief.org. That's COVIDtaxrelief.org. taxrelief.org.
Morning, Glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt from Studio West live. I am talking with Byron York of Fox News and the Washington Examiner. Good morning, Byron. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. Doing well. Thank you.
Byron, I want to read to you the first three paragraphs of a news story in The Atlantic by McKay Coppins. All right. So McKay is a fine reporter. I like McKay. He's been a guest on this show. Nice young guy. But The Atlantic's got to write something. So he writes, press them hard enough and most Republican officials, even the ones with MAGA hats in their closet and Mar-a-Lago selfies in their Twitter avatar, will privately admit that Donald Trump has become a problem. He's provided over three abysmal election cycles since he took office. He is more unstable than ever. And yet he returned to the campaign trail this past weekend, declaring that he is, quote, angry and determined to win the GOP presidential nomination in 2024. Aside from his most blinkered loyalists, virtually everyone in the party agrees it's time to move on from Trump. The next two paragraphs involve the magical thinking pervaded my recent conversations with more than a dozen current and former elected GOP officials and party strategists. What do you make of this as journalism, Byron?
Well, I read the piece, and my only thought was that's really not the situation I saw in Columbia, South Carolina on Saturday. I went to the Trump event there. You know, he had one in New Hampshire and then one in South Carolina. And it was an unusual Trump event in the sense that it was small by design. It was an invitation-only group of maybe 500 people, maybe not even quite that, inside the state capitol. The purpose was to roll out Trump's South Carolina 2024 leadership team, which included, by the way, the governor of South Carolina, Henry McMaster, and the senior senator of South Carolina, Lindsey Graham, plus Russell Fry, the representative who just got elected with Donald Trump's help, and a couple of other members of the House from South Carolina, Joe Wilson and William Timmons. So it was actually a pretty big group. So I talked to a lot of people there, and they were, you know, they were county chairs, they were activists, they were people who were politically involved. That's how they got invited. They weren't necessarily committed to Trump 2024, but what I saw was kind of a spectrum from hardcore support all the way to move on. And everybody voted for Trump in 2016 and 2020, and a lot of them still support him. They all appreciate what he did as president. Not a single person brought up the election challenge or January 6th, the ongoing investigations. I decided to just let them, you know, speak and not bring anything up myself. So basically what you saw was kind of a spectrum of Trump support with significant number of people already committed to Trump support, including the sitting governor and the senior senator.
And then that brings me back to McKay. The spectrum runs from never, never Trump, and we know who those people are, and it's about 1% to 3% of the party. Sometimes Trump, which I think is the biggest group, always Trump, which is a significant group, and only Trump, meaning that they will not vote if it's not Donald Trump. And that's not an insignificant number. But the reality of talking to Republicans is that McKay made that up and it got past his editors. And I want to get to this bottom line problem. The reality in Washington, D.C. about the Republican Party is not the reality that is reported in Washington. I went out to the RNC winter meeting on Thursday and Friday, and I've been saying forever, Ronna McDaniel is going to win by 70%. She won by 70% because it's an electorate of 168, but they had to create a horse race. Now I think they have to create, I don't know, storylines instead of just reporting what he said. When did that happen, Byron? I mean, there's no reason for McKay to sacrifice a reputation on a stupid comment like everyone wants him gone.
First of all, I'm not going to comment on whether he made anything up. I mean, you just said that there was, what, maybe 3% of the party in the Never Trump group. You can find a bunch of people and talk to them. I mean,
you can.
Talking to a party. And so you could report, you know, accurately what they said. I mean, the big problem was when he said something to the effect that everybody in the party wants, you know, Trump gone. They're just afraid to take any action themselves. So it wasn't, you know, it just wasn't what I saw. And, you know, one of the things I thought was really interesting in this race is that Nikki Haley, the former governor of South Carolina. South Carolina is in an unusual situation. They have two people who might run, Nikki Haley, the former governor, and Tim Scott, the current senator. And among other things, Trump's event was kind of a message to Nikki Haley, which is, it sounds like you're getting about ready to run, but just remember the governor and the senior senator of your own state.
And Joe Wilson, the chairman of your delegation.
Are for somebody else.
Yeah, and Joe Wilson, whose son is the attorney general and the heir apparent. But when he writes, aside from his most blinkered loyalists, virtually everyone in the party agrees it's time to move on from Trump. It's bad reporting, Byron. The reason I point that out is then when Trump does well, and he will do well, I don't know if he'll be the nominee, I'm in Switzerland on that like you are, but when he does well, they will evidence surprise. It's because they're not talking to ordinary Republicans, of which this spectrum is very obviously present.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the kind of the story was, you do see, I thought, well, maybe this is hardcores versus move-ons. And, you know, sort of two groups, you know, arrayed against each other across a no man's land or something, which is not the case at all. There really is this kind of sliding scale, a spectrum between those. And people have varying degrees of enthusiasm for Trump. But the bottom line is, I mean, they all, I mean, all of them appreciate what he did as president. Some of them are one of the things I wrote about in my Washington Examiner piece about this is that they've developed some ways of talking about their misgivings about Trump. If you remember back in the early Trump years, if you talk to some people who had doubts about Trump, they would say, you know, I really love his policies, but the tweets really bother me. Well, what they really meant was that they wished he would kind of smooth off some of his rougher edges. Now they don't say that. They say, I really would love to see him back in the White House, but without the drama. So the drama refers to that just whole Trump atmosphere that comes along with his presidency and controversy, the kind of sense of chaos that would pop up in the White House.
Yeah.
But the fact is, a lot of them want to see him in the White House again.
And the magical thinking that there is magical thinking is what bothers me. Byron, let me turn quickly.
Which we should say was a lot. He, according to the article, it was just a lot of Republicans just hoping Trump would die.
Yes.
And rid them of this problem.
Yeah. And I just think it's just not true. And there it's in The Atlantic. And I believe The Atlantic may have been captured by Beltway ethic. Not that they intend to lie, but they are misled because everyone in the Beltway says the same thing to everyone because they're not on the record and they're talking to each other. Byron, in terms of Ronna McDaniel, she won with 70% of the votes on the first ballot. I was there. There was never any doubt about it. Why did the media create a horse race around Harmeet Dhillon? Not Mike Lindell. They knew that he didn't have it, but Harmeet.
Yeah.
I mean, 30% is 30%. It's not close.
I think that was basically horse racism because now Harmeet Dhillon was very accessible to the media. And as you were saying earlier, that she really ran an outside, and Drucker was saying earlier, she ran an outsider campaign. And this is an insider job. There's only 168 members.
Correct.
Of the group. You got to get 85 votes. This is small scale stuff. And you don't get them by trying to enlist people on the outside to beat up on the RNC. That's just not the way it works.
Last question has to do with Mitch Daniels. I asked David this as well. It seems to me all of Republican land is trying to message Mitch Daniels, do not run. We don't need a 75-year-old freshman senator. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, you know, I first of all, I don't have any inside knowledge about this, but did you notice that Britt Hume, you know, just legendary journalist, great journalist, a few days ago, about a week ago, tweeted, quote, having spoken with him this week, him being Mitch Daniels, having spoken with him this week, I doubt he will decide to run.
Oh, I missed that.
Having led his state government for 8 years and Purdue University in the years since, I'm not sure being a rookie senator at age 73 holds much appeal. As we said, when he actually gets into office, he would be 75. So I think, you know, Britt Hume has great journalistic instincts. He doesn't say why he thinks that, but that he did speak to Mitch Daniels. So I'm kind of influenced by that.
I miss that, and I would be influenced by that as well, because Britt is rarely, if ever, to my knowledge, wrong. Byron York on Twitter and Washington Examiner. Din, of course, on Fox News. Thank you, Byron. Welcome back, America. I can smell a bestseller a mile away. I've been doing this show for 23 years. And when we have Bethany Mandel on, we are talking with someone who is going to have a bestseller out in March called Stolen Youth, along with Carol Mackiewicz. Good morning, Bethany. Welcome. I want to talk about Stolen Youth, if you don't mind, this morning. Congratulations. You're never not writing a book. But with six children, how did you find the time to write Stolen Youth?
So it helps when no one's sleeping. And so you can, you know, write at 1 o'clock in the morning, which is what I did.
Now, you know, Bethany, you know, I am of the grandparents school with five under the age of 11. And Genghis Kate is my she's Judge Dredd at age three. But Stolen Youth, I want her to be innocent. I want all of them to be innocent. And when I explained to people, I went to the most recent Disney movie with an 11-year-old and a 9-year-old. And there's a same-sex relationship among teenage boys, which is central to the movie. And it's a PG movie. And nobody told me. I get angry that they're putting a grandparent in the position of a parent, obliging them to answer questions that may come up afterwards. That's Stolen Youth. Am I right?
Yeah. Yes, that's exactly right. And this pervasive sort of effort on the part of the woke sort of upper class to do this with children, to do this to children, it happens in every facet of their life. The media, books, on television, in school, it's everywhere. It's constant.
And so when did you set about this project, and what is the overall theme of Stolen Youth? By the way, the Frank Luntz rule is you can't sell a book unless you say the title seven times in every segment. So you've got to say Stolen Youth again and again. Why did you get motivated to write Stolen Youth?
Mary Catherine Hamm told me that advice yesterday and said, Hugh Hewitt drilled it into my brain and I'm going to drill it into yours.
Okay, very good.
So I'm all with you. So we started thinking about sort of pitching Stolen Youth and said, do we have enough for a whole book? And that's always the question, because it's a whole book. And so Carol Markowitz and I started tracking stories and tracking themes. And we opened a shared Google document. And within 4 days, we realized, I don't think that we could write a book about this, because it happens too frequently. And we have too many examples. We don't even know where to begin. And that's sort of, how we went into this. And now, you know, after we finished writing Stolen Youth and we submitted it to our publisher, then we started sending each other more stories and said, oh man, this would have been amazing for the book. This would have been amazing for the book, but we had to go to press. And so unfortunately, since we've gone to press, there have been so many more examples of this pervasive ideology that's trying to strip children of their innocence, strip them of their resiliency, and make them these sort of shells of themselves, dependent upon the government, dependent upon sort of the woke ideology to keep them sort of moving forward through life. But if you look at mental health statistics, anxiety, depression, they're very successful in stripping children of their resilience.
I cannot wait to read Stolen Youth. And the bottom line is, I was at the RNC winter meeting, which Ronna McDaniel won 70%. It was completely malpractice on the part of journalism. There was no race for the chairman that was close. There was unanimity on becoming the party of parents and standing up for the innocence of children.
Yeah.
So you're hitting a sweet spot. I think it's the one issue about which every Republican, a lot of the center, and many Democrats are agreed. This is nuts, and we're going to take control of our children's lives back. Do you think that's a movement that's beyond the Republican Party?
I do. I absolutely do. I've heard from so many different parents. When we announced Stolen Youth yesterday, I heard from a lot of friends that said, you know, our politics don't align, but I'm scared for my children. I'm scared for my children that we're telling them that they can switch genders and that I can't find a psychiatrist who would help me work through my child's mental health issues if they decide that they have taken another gender ideology, another gender identity. if they go to school proclaiming their new gender identity instead of helping my child with their bipolar disorder, with their depression, with whatever it is, the school will just back up whatever they're saying as far as their new gender identity. And the comparison is if a kid walks in with an eating disorder and their teacher and their psychiatrist and everyone in their life says, yeah, you do look kind of fat. Yeah, you might want to lose some weight. It's the same idea.
Now, what is it going to be for a generation raised on this when they hit 18 and they arrive at college? Because gender fluidity is being driven into everyone's head like a nail. And I just wonder, Tom Wolf wrote about the sort of the college scene 20 years ago. It's got to be much, much worse now.
Yeah, no, and it is getting much worse. And the result is, you know, 15 years ago when I was in college, I said, you know, wait till these folks get into the real world. And the real world, instead of breaking them and bending them to conform to the realities of adulthood, you have to go to work, you have to perform. Instead, the workplace conformed to them. And so now everyone works from home in their pajamas and their feelings matter more than their productivity. People are, you know, there was a video game a developer who was fired last week because she liked a tweet. That's the reality that we're living in the American workplace.
I cannot wait to read Stolen Youth. Bethany Mandel, follow her on Twitter at Bethany Sean Dark. Thank you, Bethany. Talk to you again next week. Don't go anywhere, America. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Hour number three, straight ahead.
Hey, everybody. It's Dwayne Patterson of the Hugh Hewitt Show. The last time we talked, I was about 3 weeks into a 50-pound weight loss project with my PhD, weightloss.com. I had lost 16 pounds after 3 weeks. Today, I've lost 50 pounds in just 12 weeks and have been able to keep it off for the last 2 months. And you can too. MyPhDWeightLoss.com has all the information, or 864-644-1900.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live from Studio West, joined by United States Senator J.D. Vance. Senator Vance, welcome. First time I've called you that. Good to have you on this morning.
Thank you, Hugh. Good to be with you.
Just 15 minutes ago, Mitch Daniels announced he is not going to run for Senate in Indiana, thus leaving Jim Banks as the only declared candidate. Have you endorsed in that race yet?
Well, Hugh, it's interesting. One of the things I was going to do on your show is announce that I'm endorsing Jim Banks, who's a dear friend and a really good guy and was very helpful to getting us across the finish line in Ohio. So I think we'll be a great conservative fighter for Indiana. I had not seen the news about Mitch Daniels. I had heard from people that he was likely not to run. Of course, he was a great governor of Indiana and an incredible Purdue University chancellor. But I think that obviously Jim's moment is now. He's a younger guy. I think he knows in some ways instinctively where the party is headed and where it needs to go. And I think he's the right guy for the job.
Now, J.D., I know you don't want to be ageist, but you can say this to me. I'm 66. I am of the opinion that people should not run their first race for the Senate after the age of 50, maybe 55, maybe 60, but definitely not after 60, because you got to be there 6 years before you even get to do anything.
Yeah, it's a fair point. I mean, I generally think, Hugh, that we need some new blood in Washington. I think ultimately it's the voter's decision, whether it's a 55-year-old, 65-year-old, or somebody younger. Do you think that there is this sense that, you know, the millennials, the Gen X folks are getting an opportunity to really show what they're made of. And that's a good thing because we need it politically. We have far too many young people who are going to the left when we need them to vote. I just think that new people bring in fresh ideas, generationally a slightly different perspective. And so it's an important part, I think, of what's going on in the country right now is this next generation of conservative leaders stepping up. And I think Jim's a very good example of that.
Jim Banks, also a veteran. He's a veteran of Afghanistan. He's a Navy man. You're a Marine, so you're crossing over a little bit, although you're both in the sea services. How important is it for us to send more and more veterans of the military to the United States Congress?
Yeah, it's a very important thing. You know, one of the crazy things is if you look at the really signal pieces of legislation, the big things that happened right after World War II, the Civil Rights Act, things like that, those were made in Congresses where you had 70, 80, you know, above 80% of the members were veterans, either of World War II or Korea. And I think that, you know, bring a different perspective to the job. I think they're obviously willing to work hard. They're willing to do the things necessary to get things done. But Banks is a proud veteran of our military. I think he's a guy who did his job, who did his service proudly. And as you know, we confront all these different challenges from Russia to China, Venezuela. You know, we have a challenge pretty much in every continent in the world right now. It's important for a guy like Jim Banks to bring that veteran's perspective.
Now, J.D. Vance, Senator Vance, when I went out and did the debate, the first debate in Ohio in 2021, there were six Republicans. They were all good, fine candidates. They were all legitimate candidates running. It was an exhausting primary that you survived and you won, and you won the general election handily. I just don't think Republicans should waste that much money on primaries, and I don't think they should waste that much time. I like Dave McCormick in Pennsylvania. I haven't picked anyone in Ohio because I think both Bernie Moreno and Matt Dolan are going to run. They're both fine candidates. They're on the stage with you. Generally, though, if we've got a great candidate standing up early, like Jim Banks in Ohio, in Indiana, and Dave McCormick in Pennsylvania, I want to clear the field. Is there anything wrong with clearing the field?
You know, Hugh, I come at this from both sides, right? I mean, obviously, I was a total upstart when I started running. People didn't think I had really any chance of winning. I was at 1% of the polls. And I do think that a competitive primary does test a person's mettle and make sure that they can take a punch and then counterpunch without being totally knocked out by it. But I think generally speaking, when we've got a very solid candidate, a guy who clearly knows how to win elections, and Jim Banks definitely knows how to win elections, I do think there's some virtue to letting that person have a clearer field so that they can focus on the task of beating the Democrats. Indiana is obviously a pretty red state, but Democrats have won recently statewide in the not too distant past, and we don't want to screw this up. I think Jim Banks is going to win the primary, whether it's competitive or not competitive. But it does seem like in Indiana, at least with Mitch Daniels dropping out, it's not going to be that competitive of a primary, but who knows?
Yeah, we also look at Pennsylvania. Dave McCormick is a veteran of the 82nd Airborne. He's a little bit older than my test. Are you going to get involved in Pennsylvania?
You know, I haven't talked to Dave, actually. I'm not opposed to getting involved in Pennsylvania before I make any decision there. I think he ran a fine primary campaign, and frankly, to get as close as he did against the Trump endorsement is no small feat. I think he lost that primary by, 900 votes? So he's clearly a solid guy. We'll see who else runs in Pennsylvania. But we have to win that seat, and I think if we get the right candidate, Hugh, we can win that seat. Trump won Pennsylvania in 2016. Obviously, Pat Toomey won in 2016. It is not a blue state. It's a purple state, but the right Republican can definitely win.
Let's also talk about the other two border states. In West Virginia, Governor Justice sure sounds like he's running for Senate. I think he will blow out Joe Manchin. In fact, I think Joe Manchin will retire rather than get beaten by Governor Justice. Do you have any opinions on that one, J.D.?
Yeah, I suspect that'll be a pretty tough primary just because it is West Virginia. Hopefully not so tough that these candidates destroy themselves. And this is maybe the point to make about competitive primaries. It's one thing if people run energetic campaigns where they work to earn the votes of the people. That's exactly as it should be. It's something else to spend $100 million tearing down fellow Republicans. That's, of course, what happened in Ohio during our primary. I'm certainly hopeful we can avoid that in Ohio in 2022. And I'd love to avoid that in West Virginia in 23. And I'd love to avoid that in West Virginia as well. I do think that Joe Manchin is unfortunately just not in line with where his constituents in West Virginia are. He's taken some hard votes against the energy industry when that provides a lot of good jobs and is frankly one of the reasons why we have the inflation crisis we do today. So I suspect you're right that Joe Manchin will not serve another term representing West Virginia. We'll see who ultimately gets to take him on.
Now, one of the parties that's in a mess is that team up north comes from a state that is in a mess. Pennsylvania Republican Party is in a mess. The Ohio Republican Party is in pretty good shape. I don't have any opinion on Michigan at all. I don't know, but it doesn't seem to me. Does it seem to you that Michigan should be that much different from Ohio's politics?
No, it really shouldn't. I mean, obviously, I'm a little biased against Michigan, Hugh, because I'm an Ohio guy. But separating interstate rivalries, it really should not have, you know, two Democratic senators. The thing that's important for folks to appreciate is it's beat a popular incumbent than it is to win an open seat, right? This is why Sherrod Brown is a tough guy in 2024, even though Ohio is trending more red. It's why we have such a good opportunity with Debbie Stabenow stepping down. We don't have to face a popular, well-known, well-supported incumbent. We have the opportunity to take on somebody who's relatively new to politics and doesn't have that statewide name recognition. So if we get the right candidate in Michigan, I think we can't win that seat. The problem, as you said, Hugh, is it seems to me from an outsider's perspective, like the Michigan Republican Party is just not as strong as the Ohio Republican Party.
No, it's not. And hopefully they will coalesce around a veteran and someone who's younger rather than older. Let me talk about Matt Dolan and Bernie Moreno. I don't expect you to endorse today in that. And I gather the Secretary of State might get in as well. I am hopeful, and I will go to Ohio whenever they want me to moderate a debate between them. I think the more debates, the merrier among serious people. Do you agree with that, J.D.?
I do. I think it's very good. It's very good for the voters to get to see it. It's good practice for the candidates. Of course, the debates were a huge part of the general. Had some primary debates. And yeah, Hugh, you know, I'm not ready to endorse yet. I like Matt Dolan. Bernie Moreno is a dear friend, was very helpful to us primary and the general election last time around. So we'll see what ultimately unfolds there. But I do think we're going to have a very strong candidate come out of that field in Ohio.
Now, I want to switch over to presidential politics with you, J.D., and then go back to the work of a new senator. President Trump campaign in New Hampshire and South Carolina this weekend. McKay Coppins has a piece in The Atlantic that says only a very small group of people want Trump to be back in the race. That's just wrong. It's not true. There's at least 25 to 40% of the Republican Party that wants him to be the nominee in a hardcore way. Why do Beltway reporters just write things that are not true?
I don't know, Hugh. I think it's just because the social circle that they run in, and maybe McKay Coppins' social circle, nobody wants Trump to run. But in Ohio Republican circles, I'd say well over half the people in our party want Trump to run and will vote for him in the primary if he does. You know, look, I'm planning to support the president in 24. I'm actually going to have an article come out here in the next couple of days that explains why. But the simple fact is, Donald Trump's policies were incredibly good for this country, and he is very popular among Republican voters. That doesn't mean he's going to be given the nomination, of course. Who knows what's going to happen in a potentially competitive primary. But I think he deserves a chance to govern again, and certainly Republican voters, a lot of them are on his side.
Are you going to endorse Donald Trump in this article, Senator Vance?
That is the plan, Hugh. But when I lay it out in my own words, I won't do that on your show.
Oh, well, you just did. I mean, that's a double announcement. You endorsed Trump and Jim Banks. Let me close with this. How do you like being a freshman senator?
You know, it's fun. You know, I'm having a good time. You know, it's a little slow here. The Democrats have not had that many votes. The business of the Senate has not really started. I think we're going to get committee assignments here in the next couple of days. So it's still a little slow going. I guess it's not the worst thing with the Democrats in control, but I'm having a good time. I pinch myself every day, man. It's a great honor to serve.
Well, thank you for making lots of news on the Hugh Hewitt Show, endorsing Jim Banks and Donald Trump on the same day, J.D. We like that a lot. Keep coming back whenever you want to make news, and thank you for picking the Hugh Hewitt Show. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
You know what? That's a double. That's a double endorsement from J.D. Vance on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Jim Banks for Senate in Indiana, Donald Trump for president in 2024. Don't go anywhere. Chris Christie is next. America, stay tuned on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt in Studio West, joined by former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. Good morning, Governor. How are you?
Great, Hugh. How are you?
Good. Jim Banks just got the endorsement on this show by J.D. Vance, new senator from Ohio. Does that surprise you? Are you happy to see Republicans acting to clear fields in easy states?
Yeah, no, look, Jim Banks is an outstanding member of Congress. Jim and I have been friends for a number of years when he was chairing Republican Study Committee. He invited me a number of times to come and speak to the group. And I think Jim is an outstanding candidate. And I'm glad that Republicans are working with each other to try to win again. You know, we got to stop losing. Yeah. And I think it's a good way to do it.
The NRSC, Steve Daines, came out minutes later and said the NRSC is endorsing Jim Banks. That is a repudiation of the don't play in primary rules. What do you make about that, Chris Christie?
I like it. And I had that. I repudiated that rule when I was the chairman of the Republican Governors Association. If I felt like there was someone who we needed to help in a primary to give us the best chance to win a governorship, that's what we did. And I when they did it again, Doug Ducey did it again this year, playing in primaries, most particularly in defending Governor Brian Kemp in Georgia. And we see how that turned out. So we need to be doing things. We need to be decisive. Leaders are supposed to lead, Hugh, and that means sometimes making difficult, uncomfortable decisions in politics. But we got to start winning again. We cannot allow the Democratic Party to be controlling everything in this country other than a narrow majority in the House and a one-seat majority among the nation's governors.
Now, J.D. Vance also endorsed Donald Trump for the 2024 nomination on my program this morning. Your reaction to that, Governor Christie?
Well, look, I think that's a mistake. And I think it's a mistake largely because Donald Trump has shown a track record since 2016 of doing nothing but losing politically. And so I think it's contrary to what J.D. was doing regarding Jim Banks. But look, we also know there's a tradition in politics among some of paying off debt. And this must be paying a debt back to Donald Trump for having endorsed J.D. Vance, because it makes no sense otherwise politically.
Now, I spent some of the time at the RNC winter meeting talking to the national committeeman from New Jersey about you. I told him to give you a hard time when I saw him. He was a Harmeet Dillon guy. What do you make of the situation at the RNC where Rana, who I endorse, won 70% on the first ballot? The national news media tried to turn that into a story. It wasn't a story.
Oh, look, I think it's always interesting for the national media to focus on 168 Republicans. I don't think it has any significance one way or the other, quite frankly, Hugh. And I don't think that the national committee chairmanship has a whole lot of significance when you don't have a president. And so she's not the one who's going to be making the predominant number of decisions regarding what we do in this country politically. And so I think it was a story really about not much of anything.
The key thing that the RNC does is set up a debate schedule, which I believe is going to begin in July in Milwaukee. What do you think of the timing of that?
I think that's fine. I would have even liked earlier because I think the more the American people can hear from the potential candidates for president, the better off they're going to be, the more robust the debate should be. It should be substantive. We should know what these candidates know and don't know, what they stand for and what they oppose. I thought the debates in 2016 fell a little bit short in that regard, to say the least. And I'm hoping that debates in 2024 will be ones where, you know, the candidates on that stage are challenged on their views and on what they know and what they stand for.
Well, if I'm on the stage asking questions, I'm going to ask whether or not we sink Chinese ships that are sailing for Taiwan. Yesterday, Mike Minahan, a general of the Air Force who runs the Air Force Command associated with moving troops and equipment, said, we're going to be in war in 2025. What do you make about that, Governor Christine? If you were the president, would you order the torpedoes fired at Chinese ships headed towards Taiwan?
Well, I'd like to do a lot more before that to try to prevent that from happening to you. And I think we have to be much more robust. I think Ukraine is teaching us the lesson of having not given everything that a country needed to defend itself. That ability prevents war much more than what you do afterwards once the war starts. And so I'd like to be much more aggressive and would be much more aggressive there. And also in the decoupling of our economic interests from the Chinese as well. We need to be able to depend on American manufacturing, American production for the things that are vital to us. If we didn't learn that from the COVID experience, we really learned nothing. And finally, the Chinese need us a lot more than we need them. Their problems are much graver than ours are in this country, and we should not be trying to help them along when they're being belligerent in the South China Sea and in a lot of other places around the world.
Well, Governor, it seems to me Joe Biden is infirm and the vice president is not going to win the spelling bee anytime soon. Isn't this the window that the Chinese want and have waited for a long time?
Except, yes, in one respect, too, but I also think they're not prepared. He's still not prepared militarily to do what he wants to do. Secondly, he's got a ton of internal problems in that country. You saw it by what he did at the last meeting of the Chinese Communist Party. He's trying to purge himself of anybody who would dissent on anything that he does, but he's got a lot of internal political problems. I think he knows from watching Putin and what's happening to Putin in Russia that he's not ready for this kind of confrontation in Taiwan, even though he looks at Biden and Harris and knows this is the opportunity to get it done, because with a Republican president and vice president in the White House in 2025, it will be a much different story.
Okay, last question, Governor. I know you're not going to announce for president on this show today unless you want to surprise me. Are you going to announce for president today?
No, I'm not.
Okay, so.
But God love you for trying, you.
Yeah, I know. I'm always going to ask, when do you have to make a decision in order to be competitive and raise money?
I think late spring.
Is that like March?
No, March would be early spring, wouldn't it? I would say April, May is when you have to make a final decision.
And do you have a pack up and running yet? A super pack?
My pack, I still have a pack open for 2016 views, but I have not started to actively raise money for that pack and for any effort for 2024 yet, no.
Do you lose your chair on this week if you run for president?
Yes.
That's a bummer. You're the last Republican on the Sunday shows. I mean, really, the last Republican on the Sunday show. Have you noticed that?
I believe me, I acutely feel it every Sunday, not only on the set at ABC, but I feel it acutely as I look at and watch the other shows. And the fact is that there's a dearth of a Republican voice, and I feel an obligation every Sunday to be making that voice heard across the country for the things that we believe in, and to remind people that the truth matters, Hugh. And I try every Sunday to speak the truth on those shows because we need, the American people want that, or are hungry for that more than anything else.
Why has that happened, Governor? Why are there no Republicans? I mean, that seat that you hold was held by George Will for a while. There are no big name Republicans left. I mean, hardcore Republicans left on Meet the Press or Face the Nation or State of the Union. They're just gone. What happened?
I think it's a twofold problem. One, I don't think those networks want really outspoken, strong Republicans. That's the first problem. And so they put it on Republicans like John Kasich, for instance, on CNN. Secondly, I think that Republicans are reluctant to go on those programs for two reasons. One, because they fear they're not going to be treated fairly. And two, because they look at it and say, how many people that I care about are really watching? My opinion is different. I'm not worried about being treated fairly. I get on and I can debate and defend my principles and our party's principles against anybody sitting in any of those chairs. And secondly, I do think the American people watch. You know, there's almost 4 million people watching ABC every Sunday. That's a significant number of folks who are decision makers who I'm trying to influence, but even more so, a lot more people see it in social media in the week afterwards.
That's true.
And I can tell you the reaction I got to, you know, calling a lot of our candidates losers on Sunday has been overwhelming over the last 2 days.
There are two kinds of Republicans on network television, refugees and missionaries. And I have been a missionary forever on network television. You're a missionary forever. But we're down to, like, you're the last missionary on the old legacy station, and everyone else is a refugee, and they go on there just to hate on people. It's not, last comment, Chris, you've been around media a long time. This is not a way to expand audience.
No, it's a losing proposition. And I can tell you, when I walk through airports, which I do a lot as I'm traveling around the country, everybody talks to me about watching me on ABC, and when it's a Republican, they say, they look at the preview queue when the show gets teased, and if they don't see me on the roundtable, they turn it off. That should tell network executives that there's a big Republican audience out there that would be willing to watch if they would put some missionaries on the program.
Missionaries, not refugees. Chris Christie, always a pleasure to talk to you, Governor. Remember, when you make news, come here and tell. Just be like J.D., Governor. Just be like J.D.
I will, Hugh. Remember, spring training starts in 18 days.
Okay, and you know what? I hope Lindor comes through for you because we still have the best end of that deal thus far.
We'll see this year, Hugh. We'll
All right, take,
year.
Take care, Governor. Bye-bye.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
with in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.